Well, now to something rare, an inspirational story about the United Nations, and that of a life combining modesty with daring action. Many of you might already know of a man called Dag Hammarskjöld, a Swede. He led the UN from 1953 to 61. Certainly a household name when I was growing up, probably less remembered today, though he should be. He pioneered the use of peacekeeping forces and championed a kind of diplomacy at odds with much contemporary practice. And he was a man of considerable spiritual depth, as you'll hear. He eschewed the notion of diplomacy as a game of one-upmanship and believed instead in what he called the fundamentals of good negotiation: careful preparation, truthfulness, precision, patience, modesty. He's the only person to have been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize posthumously, also the only head of the UN to die in office, in a plane crash in Central Africa. And I've been reading the details of this extraordinary individual this week, thanks to a new biography called Hammarskjöld, A Life. It's by the US writer Roger Lipsey, who I'm delighted to say joins us this morning. Roger, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Just before we talk about the work and the life of the man, I'd like to try to clarify what is known about the plane crash in which he died, because late last year a report was published suggesting there was an aerial attack on the plane rather than the original finding of pilot error. Precisely what came out of the more recent investigation?
Yeah, it's still ongoing. In September 2011, a really brilliant English scholar and writer named Susan Williams published a book called Who Killed Hammarskjöld? And it's a very serious, beautifully researched book, and it set in motion, from zero interest, a whole process. The next element in the process was the formation of a Hammarskjöld Inquiry Commission, and they finished up their work last October. They submitted their findings to Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, who was so impressed with the findings that he has now formally asked the General Assembly to consider all the evidence afresh and to begin to reach some new conclusions if it's merited. So this 50-year-old mystery is now reopened, thanks largely to Susan Williams and to the Hammarskjöld Commission.
That commission, didn't it suggest there was strong evidence for some sort of aerial attack on the plane by persons or countries unknown?
That's exactly right. The courts at that time, the inquiries that were launched locally, disregarded the testimony of anyone, black or white, who said that they saw something in the air, like a small plane pursuing the larger plane. Many, many witnesses said that, and all of that evidence was disregarded. So when the UN did its inquiry, it trusted the local, then Northern Rhodesian inquiry, now Zambia, as you know.
Now old men.
Yeah, but what has happened is that a lot of old men and old women have testified in the very recent times and have really reopened the whole question. I believe that there's going to be, let's just put it this way, apologies ahead.
All right, well, let's leave that little mystery hanging there. And let's go to the man. John F. Kennedy described him as the greatest statesman of his century, the 20th. What prompted him to say that?
Well, of course, he said that posthumously. He said that after it was safe to praise Mr. Hammarskjöld. What prompted it was his, I should think, looking back over the whole history of Hammarskjöld's work at the UN, first of all in China, when he single-handedly negotiated the freeing of some American pilots who had been imprisoned by the Chinese as spies and who were presumably going to spend the rest of their lives in a Chinese prison. And in working with Zhu Enlai, for whom he had very high regard, Hammarskjöld freed those pilots. And the U.S., then it was Eisenhower's administration, was most grateful and then began to notice Dag Hammarskjöld. Then Suez came along when the British and French and Israelis conspired to take over the recently nationalized Suez Canal and to, as far as the British and French were concerned, they were interested in pulling down the Nasser regime. And Hammarskjöld, again, working with a brilliant Canadian, Lester Pearson, conceived the idea of peacekeeping forces, inserted them at the Suez Canal, stopped the war, stopped the violence. Mm. And that was an amazing feat. It saved face for the British and French, who hardly deserved it. It was an extraordinary diplomatic feat.
Yes, we take it for granted now, but it was very much a breakthrough, and it was an immensely clever device, which
exactly.
Everybody leapt on, didn't they? And there is a lovely moment where you say he had a lovely dry humour. He said to his great lieutenant, I think it's Mr. Bluke, said, "All right, Corporal, now go and get me an army." Because they had nothing.
He also said to the British, you know, "We saved you from success." It was another example of his dry wit.
And in many ways, of course, he articulated what the UN... He was the second Secretary General, was he not? Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And here we were in this immensely complicated time in the 50s with the Cold War absolutely roaring along, if it doesn't sound too oxymoronic to say that, So many issues. We think we live in difficult times, but that, you know, that was certainly the case. And he really articulated the notion of what the UN might stand for. And I wonder if that was because of this interior life of this man, which is what you've been so fascinated by. Inside his briefcase, recovered from the crash site in Africa, was a copy of the New Testament, a German edition of poems by Rainer Maria Rilke, copies of the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber's I and Thou in German and English, and a French novel. And in his wallet was a scrap of paper with the verses of Bebopalula and the American newspaper cartoons that were mocking him. So it's quite revealing, isn't it? A deep thinker, obviously, yet one connected to the real world.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I think that the verses from Bebopalula were given him by some of the kids of families that he was close to. So I don't think that represented his taste in music. But he was extremely diverse, natured man. And you said that he gave the UN its mission, its sense of mission, its dignity. I think that's very, very true. It was waiting there to be accomplished. It needed someone to articulate what the UN was about. And he did so with wonderful quiet eloquence and very perseveringly. It was one of his great contributions. And I don't think it's, even though the UN has great, great difficulties, can't solve the problem of Syria, stumbles over Crimea, stumbles over African problems, there's nonetheless a DNA there that is intact and forward-looking, and it comes from him.
We know he was passionate about creating dialogue between adversaries, but how did he do that? What do we know about the techniques he used in heated and difficult situations?
You know, he would have written a manual of diplomacy had he lived, I'm quite sure. He would have based it on his experience. And there are so many points in what we have from him before his sudden death that point toward a, let's call it a philosophy of diplomacy. For example, in Markings, which is the journal that was published after his death, he said something really highly significant. I'll just quote it. "You can only hope to find a lasting solution to a conflict if you have learned to see the other objectively, but at the same time to experience his difficulties subjectively." Mm. Now, that is an act of awareness. And the main point to grasp about Hammarskjöld's approach to a life of action in the diplomatic world is that he did so from a mobile, seeking, curious awareness that he had cultivated over a lifetime. So from my point of view, and I'm quite sure from his, a trained awareness is one of the keys to his kind of diplomacy, which was based on integrity, on study of the issues, on a way of perceiving the adversary that is, I'll use a foolish word, forward-looking.
Yes, well, what is so interesting about the man that you reveal is that he had a lot of depth, but he was daring, And he had this quality of wiliness as well that, you know, in all the readings I've done about leadership, it continues to come back. So the notion of the pure saint looking for solutions generally doesn't work. And for instance, he talks about the need for political wisdom and that a closed mind is a weakness. A sound political education is, among other things, opportunistic and agile, always in progress, never complete. And he thought it crucial to follow and continuously absorb not only what others are and do, but also, and just as crucially, for oneself. So this was a man who, he was obviously a highly intelligent individual, but constantly driving himself to understand more?
That's right. I mean, I characterize him as having a monastic temperament, but with very, very great rigor. If you don't mind, I'll just read you something that confirms what you're saying about shrewdness. It's something that I didn't find in time to put into the biography. He was talking one day with one of his adversaries, the French foreign minister at the time of Suez, and they were talking cordially about the search for peace among warring neighbors. And Hammarskjöld said this: "To that end, I start by seizing on the problem in the name of the United Nations. Then I guard against proposing a solution too quickly. Coming from me, it would immediately be suspect and rejected. But I complicate matters as much as possible. I multiply exploratory conversations. I act like a spider tying up an insect to immobilize it before eating it. I weave my threads around the problem to the point of making it invisible, or, if you prefer, incomprehensible. In the end, people no longer have a clear notion of what made them adversaries and renounce fighting."
Wow, isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah, and he added to that, alas, it's not always a success.
Well, my guest, by the way, is Roger Lipsey. He's an author and biographer, and he's produced a remarkable book, I think, called Hammarskjöld, A Life, as published by the University of Michigan Press. Another very interesting observation of his: in my line of work, you either get very cynical or very serious. He chose to get serious. He also had some interesting things to say about exercising authority. "Your position," he wrote, "never gives you the right to command. It only imposes on you the duty of so living your life that others can receive your orders without being humiliated." Were his political values learned primarily through experience, Roger, or through reading and thinking, or his upbringing? I'm quite intrigued.
Yeah. Some authors have said that Sweden in the beginning of the 20th century was still an Enlightenment country. It was still an 18th century European environment. He had an extraordinary education. His father was the prime minister of Sweden during World War I.
Yes, he was quite a political aristocrat, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, he in effect studied at the knee of his father. He entered the government early. As an economist initially, the Swedish government, he was part of the Swedish government during World War II. How difficult was that? Because Sweden was ostensibly neutral, but in fact, they couldn't get along without making compromises with the Nazis. So his political education was intense.
I just wonder, how would he have dealt with a man like Putin, a chess player like Putin? Well, he's just so interesting to watch. Who knows what's coming next? And he plays a situation absolutely for his own ends. And he seems to me to be the polar opposite of what you're describing here in Hammarskjöld. But Hammarskjöld would have had to deal with someone just like him.
Well, he dealt with Khrushchev, who was quite similar. And to tell the truth, he dealt with David Ben-Gurion, the Prime Minister of Israel, who was quite similar in his strong nationalism that overrode many other considerations that a man of his intellect might have had. So both Khrushchev and David Ben-Gurion are examples of difficult nationalistic leaders with whom he dealt quite well.
And I wonder about, in a sense, how we might apply his model to the present day, because I think that's you want. And you said, when you were talking about him at the UN in a marvellous address recently, how to use him as a working example. He was a sign of what is possible, you think, still?
I do. You know, I thought a lot about models, because he does represent a model, a kind of ideal. And It seems to me that the best way, that the immature way to approach a model is to model yourself on that person. That the mature way, the deeper way, is to really, really assimilate everything possible from that person, just to take it in, to listen, and then not do anything, and let all that work its influence within you. So, for example, Hammarskjöld was really very courageous, both physically, there's a number of examples of that, but he was morally courageous. So he wrote to one of his colleagues from the Middle East once, once you go headfirst into it, even the most impossible task may show unexpected opportunities. So one listens to that, and one sees that it's both extreme and utterly faithful to human possibility. Mm. There's nothing to be done in relation to it. One just listens. But if one listens well to this man, which I hope many Australians will, you know, if one reads about him and reads markings and just takes in the model, it can be very influential in a creative, unconstrained way.
Look, half of me wants to leave it just there, but I suppose I must just say for a final that we, as Michael Ignatieff, we've had on the program and has written a very interesting review of your book, says, it must be recognised that he died in the Congo. He strode in, led the UN into a nightmare of great power rivalry, and they're still there. There's still, I think, 20,000 troops in the Congo all these years afterwards. It didn't work, as it were. We still had all the terrible fighting that has occurred. 3 million people probably died. So despite all of these abilities you're describing, and I fully concede that, you can't necessarily pull off miracles, can you?
No, he was kept out of Tibet. He was called upon by the Dalai Lama to somehow organize a UN peacekeeping force against the Chinese invasion of Tibet. There was nothing to be done about that. He was kept out of Hungary when the Soviets rolled their tanks into Budapest. There were limits, there always have been limits, to what the UN and its Secretary General can achieve. However, in the Congo, the forces of decolonization and what some people call neo-colonization, this reshuffling all the cards so that you come out in the same place but with a different appearance, those were such huge forces at work that the UN would have had to hang its head in shame if it didn't intervene. And I'll also say that two men were killed. Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, and 6 months later, Doug Hammarskjöld was, I think, assassinated. When you subtract those two formidable leaders, Lumumba, immature, nutty, but nonetheless he had the heart of the people with him, and Hammarskjöld, who's one of the great figures of diplomacy and spirituality in this or any other age, subtract those two men, and things are not necessarily going to go very well. Mm. Someone wanted them to not go very well.
Roger Lipsey, thank you so much for assembling all this.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks to you.
Roger Lipsey and his Hammarskjöld, A Life, is published by the University of Michigan Press. There's also a website dedicated to Hammarskjöld that you can find, if you like, by typing his name into your search engine. And it has a lot of links, terrific links, to UN audio archives, amongst other material.